Welcome to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology, brought to you by the Media Economies and Design Lab at CU Boulder. I am your host, Antoinette Kendrick, and joining me on the program today is Dr. Dana Boyd. Dr. Boyd is a leading researcher, scholar, and thought leader in the fields of technology, social media, and youth culture. She's a partner researcher at Microsoft Research, the founder of the nonprofit organization Data and Society, and a visiting distinguished professor at Georgetown University. With a focus on how young people navigate the complexities of social media and digital environments, Boyd's work has deeply influenced how scholars, policymakers, and technologists understand privacy, identity, and information practices in the digital age. Her book, It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens, that came out in 2014, has been hailed as a foundational text on youth digital culture, examining the nuanced ways teenagers use platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to negotiate peer dynamics and societal expectations. Her research has highlighted the ways digital networks amplify existing social inequalities, offering critical insights into the intersection of technology, power, and surveillance. As a sought-after speaker, Boyd frequently contributes to the public discourse on issues such as algorithmic bias, online harassment, and the ethical challenges of big data. Her innovative work continues to push the boundaries of understanding how technology shapes human interaction, with a particular emphasis on its impact on youth. Please join me in welcoming our esteemed guest, Dr. Dana Boyd. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Boyd. It's a pleasure. You're a juggernaut of the field of media studies and beyond. And we're happy
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, I wanted to start off, just in case some of our listeners aren't familiar with your work just yet, I wanted to ask if you could start off by telling our listeners a little bit about your life trajectory and how you got interested in social media and youth.
Yeah, no, sure. So I was a teenager who grew up in rural Pennsylvania, and I was a queer kid and a geek, and I didn't fit in many, many levels. And at one point, my brother was taking up the phone line, which was like not an acceptable use in an after-school activity. So I marched into his room and I'm like, what are you doing? Because the phone's making beep, beep, beep sounds. And he was like, I'm talking to people. I'm like, you're not talking to people. You're on a computer. And so my brother introduced me to the early days of Usenet, which was a platform kind of like Reddit of today. And so I was like, this is fascinating. So I spent my teenage years finding all sorts of people all over the internet to talk to, for which I am grateful because I think of, you know, some of those interactions very much saved my life. And then I went to college thinking I was going to study math. And I was assigned an advisor on day one. And he was a computer scientist. And he's like, why aren't you taking my class? I'm like, because I don't know what computer science is. And he's like, well, you can build the systems that you like playing with. I'm like, okay, that sounds good. And so I studied computer science, but I just kept finding myself interested in like different social dimensions of what was happening on the internet. And so I started what we would now call a blog in 1997, which was just me writing my thoughts onto the internet and, you know, building community and having a blast. And then for various reasons, ended up going to Amsterdam for a study abroad to focus on gender and sexuality. And I was there and I was in a bookstore and I was just dying to read something in English. And I found this book, a book that was about identity and, or this book with an article in it was about identity and deception on the internet. I'm like, this is fact. And so I reached out to the professor who was at the time at MIT, and I would go on to then be one of her students to look at what was called sociable media at the time. And when we were demonstrating some of our visualization work, which is what I was doing at the time, to different people, someone came up to me and was like, hey, you know, there's this new site that's starting out called Friendster. I think you might find it really interesting. And so in December of 2002, I went on to what would become the first of the next big wave of social network sites and started first visualizing them, and then analyzing how people were using them. And then I decided I was going to quit studying social media in order to understand how teenagers use technology, just in time for them to also join social media. And it went from there.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. That leads itself into a student question that I had. I told my students, they in this class, social media cultures, that we would be reading multiple texts from you, which we've read too, and told them that I'd be getting to interview with you. And I asked them, do you have any questions for Dana? They were gaga, super excited. And so I just had a few questions that I took from their questions. They wanted to know what brings you into this work, which really you kind of spoke to, but what keeps you in this work and how do you get this information? Because they were surprised with how accurate a lot of what you had to say was for their experience growing up online. And so they just wanted to know, how do you know this stuff? How do you find it out?
Yeah. So it's funny because I started out as a computer scientist. The irony is that I took the only social science class I took in undergrad was a psychology class on sleep. And it was mostly so that I could sleep during class. It was really great, terrible logic. So in undergrad years. But it was in grad school where I started being curious, just asking why. Why were people doing what they were doing? And not just why as in like a critical why, like, oh my gosh, why are you doing that? But like a genuine curious why. Like, huh, I would have never thought to do that. Why are you doing that? And so it was interesting because when I was in MIT in my first attempt at grad school, there was an anthropologist named Genevieve Bell who had just been hired by Intel. And she was told to go to MIT and find a summer intern. It was her first year there. And so she and I got to talking and she's like, you're fascinating. And how do none of you know anything about social science? And, because we were really a computer science place. And so I arrived in Portland to spend the summer working with her. And she's like, where are your books? And I was like, I don't have any books. She's like, how do you not have books? And I was like, what do I need books for? And she was just, it just blew her mind as an anthropology PhD. She sent me with a credit card down to Powell's book and gave me a list of books. And she's like, you will read these in the first week. I was like, yes, ma'am. And, she sort of introduced the idea of interviewing to me. She introduced the idea of qualitative research. And I was like, oh, I can take my why questions and turn them into something more than just like random thoughts in my head. And so, which was a really funny exercise. And then after I dropped out of my first PhD program, which I did after 9/11, and I was in San Francisco and I was looking for work. And there was a guy that I had met. He was like, oh, I want to hire people to understand why people are using some of these, what we now think of as nascent social media sites. And I'm like, I can do that, which was complete bullshit. I didn't know anything about what I was doing. But I successfully bullshitted myself into that job. And it was like, oh, maybe I should learn some things about interviewing and, focus groups and like all these things that I knew nothing about, but, was confident that I could figure out. And so it was in some ways this crash course in this, job for a startup that led me to start asking questions. And then I went back and got my actual PhD. And when I went to Berkeley for that, I just took method class after method class. And I was like, okay, what are all the different ways in which you can ask why, how, And so the book that, you're referring to, the It's Complicated book and the work that's related to that era of youth was actually me genuinely being out talking to young people everywhere. And I forget exactly how many official interviews there are in that book, 100 and something. But the thing is that in addition to that, I was also continuing to work for various companies in order to pay the rent. And so I was talking to, lots and lots of young people separately that are not in that book. So it was like really, I felt like I was immersed in, these different worlds that I was, trying to represent. And I just found myself, regularly in a position where, I was asked to talk back to adults. And I can't tell you how many teenagers were like, can you explain this to my mom? Right? Like, she's driving me crazy. And so, I just also got to that moment where like, how do I keep explaining this and explaining like, what we forget about young people's lives. And so I just felt like in some ways I got to be an amplifier of their voices. And that was a real privilege, right? Like that was really amazing. And I'll tell you a funny story, which is there was a set of political hearings at the time over a possible piece of regulation. And it was really, really like not designed to be supportive of youth at all. And, at the time I was writing everything on my blog all the time. And teenagers by this point are correcting me on my blog all the time, right? They're like telling me things that I've got wrong. And like, it was a great feedback cycle. And so I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to do this event. And this small group of teenagers who lived, in relative distance to DC came adorably dressed up, right? Like being like, I could do this. And at one point, there was a congressional member, a senator, who was screaming at me and just being like, you don't know anything about young people, blah, 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 right? Because he had a particular political agenda. And this 15-year-old boy just stood up and just yelled back at the senator and, you know, was just like, she knows what she's talking about. Let her speak. And I was like, I love you. You're so, aw, adorbs.
That's so sweet. I love it when they speak to the truth and they see the truth. That's really impressive. I'm wondering, because you brought up this kind of era of research and it's complicated, the network lives of teens. When you wrote this, you weren't a parent yet. And so I'm just kind of wondering, how has your research changed since having your kids and the strategies that inform your approach?
Yeah, so I should note that when I published It's Complicated, in fact, I edited the final pieces of it while my eldest was, you know, a few weeks old. And I made myself a promise, which is that I was going to stop studying teenagers while I was going to parent my kids, because I found that when you turn your kids into a research subject, things get a little weird. And I'd watched enough of that. And so I decided I was not going to do that. Instead, I decided that I was going to devote my energies to volunteer as a volunteer for one part of the puzzle that was harrowing to me, and that had to do with mental health. And so instead of doing research on young people, I continued on lots of other research topics. But instead of doing research on young people, I decided to help found a mental health organization called Crisis Text Line, and that would be available for young people in crisis. And part of it was one of the pieces that my research had led me to is that young people turn to the internet to cry out for help, and who's out there helping them. And because, you know, I remember this from my own years, it's like those darkest nights, you're just looking for somebody you can talk to, somebody who can keep you grounded. And so I was really proud to be able to, you know, devote 10 years to, you know, board service, really sort of founding this organization, supporting it, strengthening it, building, you know, its research program on its own, which was great work. And then I continued on my own research path, and I kept in touch with other researchers. And we can talk about more recent work that I've come back into the space due to a bunch of regulation that I'm finding very irritating. But as a parent, one of the things that was sort of interesting to me was that I did research on a lot of young people. And what I learned is that parents are kind of hysterical. They're really like parents are very anxious, and that the more anxious and hysterical they are, the less healthy it is for their kids. And that kids from relatively privileged backgrounds are generally okay. That there's a lot you can do to support them, and there's a lot that can be done. And so one of the things I would say that I took from my research was to just chill out, right? And as a parent, like my real strategy and my real lesson here is just like, you know, I'm going to make this, you know, a conversational process. I'm going to engage with you, you know, and support you, but I'm going to try to not be the hovering parent that drives you crazy. And it's even, you know, because people ask me all the time, they're like, well, you know, what are your policies on technology? And I'm like, well, my kids and I have been talking about technology since the beginning. And so one of the things I always, you know, encourage parents of like newborns to do is that, you know, every time you want to pick up your phone, right? And you're going to go stare at it, rather than just doing that and like checking out from your baby, verbalize everything you're doing. This is a really interesting thing to do. I am picking up the phone to call your other parent. I am picking up the phone to get directions to where we're going. I am picking up the phone to order food, right? These are all reasonable things. And you're verbalizing that this object, this phone, represents many different things, right? Like not just I am looking at, you know, whatever cute animated creature is. But the thing also what it makes you do is you're like, I'm picking up this phone so that I can doom scroll rather than hanging out with you. That's not something you're going to say. And so the other thing that, you know, spending all this time with young people taught me was that when it came to technology, parents were often a huge part of the problem. It wasn't young people's unhealthy relationships that was often front and center. Like, I can't tell you, even back then, a number of young people would just be like, can you convince my dad to get off the phone and actually watch me play the game? Right? And you're like, yeah, I hear you. Right? And so this was like, for me as a parent, it was like, I'm less worrying about my kids and more socializing them into this is part of public life.
I love that. Me and my students actually picked up on that tone really quickly. I feel like a lot of people in this space, and especially in the child policy regulating social media space, there is a lot of hysteria around the area. And you're not a fearmonger. You're not a reactionary. You're responding, but with grace and in a way that gives youth their agency as well when they are able to adaptively approach these spaces. And I really love that. I do wonder personally, absolutely. I come from the field of social work. That's my background, is in master's in social work. And the youth that I was typically exposed to, well, because it's social work, typically not in a nuclear kind of, you know, like the most protective environment. And so I wonder, actually, this might bring the next question into conversation. I was looking at your Twitter and a few days ago, you posted a post or a blog where you write about risks versus harms for youth engaging in social media, stating that, in short, does social media harm teenagers is not the same question as can social media be risky for teenagers? I love that differentiation. But I was just going to see if you could talk a little bit more about how you're framing risk here and how it could be reduced, and then maybe if how you differentiate risk from potential harm.
So for me, you know, many things in this world introduce risk, right? If I fall in love, the risk of heartbreak goes up, right? Like that is, now does that make me not want to fall in love? No, of course not, right? And I grew up in an era where the answer to any risk was some version of just say no, right? Like, you know, do drugs, just say no. And the result is that people were like, well, this isn't that bad. And then we end up in a spiral where we're not actually talking coherently about risk. We're talking about binaries. And, you know, it's like one of the things, you know, that I was part of, like a lot of, you know, feminist activism on, was just saying like, there is no such thing as safe sex. There's safer sex. And there's ways of being thoughtful about sexual interactions to reduce the likelihood in which you are going to navigate an STI or, you know, pregnancy or da, 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 da. So for me to presume that we are never going to take risks as humans is asinine, right? Like we're going to take risks. And some of us are going to pursue much more risky things. Like, and so the example that I gave, you know, being in Colorado is like skiing. Those mountains, you know, like throwing yourself down them, that is risky, right? Like I don't care what you've put on your feet. Like that's a terrifying idea. Now people love it, right? It gives them joy. It gives them pleasure. You know, there's so much enthusiasm with learning to. So how do you reduce risk? Right? You reduce risk of like, you know, ending up with a torn ACL by learning how to ski, right? Some instruction is helpful. Having the right gear is helpful. Making thoughtful choices about the state of your own sobriety is helpful, right? There's a lot of things you can do to reduce the likelihood of getting an ACL tear. Now, is it still possible? Oh yeah, right? Like I'm sure you see plenty on your campus, right? So this is that moment of like acknowledging that this is risky and has different layers of risk and giving people the choice of like, do you want to take that risk? Personally, I have no desire to throw myself down a mountain. Like I think it's insane. And I also don't have the desire to spend the money to throw myself down the mountain and end up in the hospital. But I appreciate that this is something that gives people tremendous joy. Interacting with people, participating in large scale publics has so many different kinds of risks to it. And it doesn't matter if that's happening in a mediated forum or if you're showing up to like one of the football games, right? You know, a stumbling drunk guy can end up hurting you as well, right? Like, so what do we deal with and how do we learn the dynamics and learn to find the right way to reduce the risk in the environment? And so for me, when you start to think about risk reduction, you start to think about different components of it, right? Some of them are about agency. What are the things you can do to reduce your risk? And then we start to think about some structural things, right? What are some of the things that institutions can do to reduce your risk? And the, you know, example I point out there, you know, which also comes from personal experience, is like, you know, when you're working with a small child, learning to cross the street is a really hard thing. Learning to stop at a streetlight is a hard thing, right? And you spend so much time as a parent of a young person being like, please don't kill yourself. Please don't kill yourself. Like, and you're like, stop, right? And it's this whole process. But you're also not going to continue treating an 18-year-old the same way that you treat a two-year-old. And so you build up their capacity to identify how to stop at the streetlight, to identify how to look both ways, to figure out whether or not it's safe to cross, all of these things. Can things still go wrong? Yes, right? But, and you know, the thing I joke, I took my kids to Hanoi, and I don't know how much time you've spent in that part of the world, but the streets of Hanoi are constant chaos. There are no like street walk or, you know, the crosswalk type things, none of that. Instead, you have to walk into chaotic traffic, slow and steady, so that every driver sort of works around you, because there aren't lanes either. And you cross a street, which is always going to be multiple lanes of traffic, just by going slow and steady. This is a fascinating thing to teach to small people, right? Because like small people are not good at slow and steady. They're like, let's run. No, slow and steady, right? And it just breaks the paradigm entirely. And so the difference is that, you know, we live in the US in a world where we're like, we have crosswalks and we have lights and all of these other things that we come to expect. And we assume the environment will take care of it for us. Whereas lots of people around the world do not assume the environment will take care of it for you. And they still learn how to cross the street. And so my point is that, like, I'm all in favor of building in infrastructure that makes it safer to cross the street. Like, that's great. But I also think that we need to do the work of socializing people into environments so that even when they don't have those guardrails, they can cross the street. And that, to me, is a lot of the conversations that we have with the digital environment. You can collectively not only focus on agency and your own choices, but looking out for those around you, right? Not just, you know, just what you need to do, but like, is your friend over there okay, right? And that's the important part of this, is that we are part of a collective. We check in on each other. We can be a part of, you know, a collective response to this, at the same time that we can push back and be like, yeah, I want some more guardrails put in there, please. Thank you very much.
Beautifully put. Two things came to mind with what you just said. I'm wondering, because you mentioned social media can also be a space where children or young people are manifesting or maybe exposing the states of their mental health. And I'm kind of wondering how would you suggest responding as like a follower or friend, depending on like intensity of friendship,
right,
without that kind of crisis management training?
Yeah. So this is, you know, very much back to my own, you know, personal experience, which is that when I was a teenager, you know, chatting away in various, you know, what were called BBSs, basically chat rooms, and Usenet, there were some really dark and harrowing moments in my own teenage years. And there are two people who are strangers to me that I never knew their names and I will never meet, who I very much attribute to having picked me up when I was sort of at the lowest. One was a trans woman who helped me build language for understanding gender and sexuality in a way that I really didn't have words for and didn't understand what I was feeling and how to make sense of these dynamics. And the second was a guy who was, you know, currently enlisted in the military, who helped me appreciate a bigger picture of the world than my, you know, hometown and its problems. And the way that they held me, you know, in those dark nights was just conversationally supporting me, letting me talk, letting me say really inappropriate things, because I am sure I did, right? And my first big project that led me to youth was actually when it was just a class project when I was working my master's. I wanted to go back and understand what, you know, LGBT and Q identified young people, how they were navigating the internet, because I saw it so important to me. And I realized that many of the online spaces that had been fabulous for me were no longer safe spaces for a lot of queer youth. And in particular, they were places where evangelical Christians were coming and telling them that they were going to go to hell and trying to angle them into different kinds of conversion therapy, which was sort of at its peak at that moment. And I was devastated, right? Because I was like, what's happening where young people who are struggling, who's supporting them? Who's helping them? You know, and not just indoctrination. Like, one of the things about the two people that I met is like, they never told me I was right or wrong. They just helped me get perspective, right? They were there for me without trying to tell me there's one right way to live. So I think back to that because, you know, years later, we'd have this It Gets Better campaign. And Dan Savage, who was sort of a well-known gay activist, had worked with a lot of these celebrities to make all of these videos that were posted on YouTube saying it gets better. And in response, a lot of queer youth made their own videos. And then in the preceding year and a half, I just saw incident after incident of a young person who died by suicide after making a video. And rather than getting support and love that they were hoping for, just got more tormented at school. And that scared the heck out of me. And it fast-forwarded into a lot of different things I saw in my research where it was like, young people were just coming and they were like, I need somebody. And I was like, what are we doing when we're not supporting those who are crying out for help? And so that gets to your question. When people are in a bad place, they cry out for help in any way they can, right? And the most basic thing that anybody can do is, I hear you. I love you. I'm there for you, right? Just acknowledgement, recognition. Just validation that you are human and that is a good thing, right? And then the next stages of it are about really what is your relationship? What does that person need? How are they going to move forward, right? And that's these processes where it's like, yeah, sometimes you're going to be out of your league, right? And it's about getting support. And one of the things, for example, with Crisis Text Line is that we often receive messages from bystanders asking for support. And we help bystanders through that process as well. But there's also just, you know, these different steps you can take of just like, who is there for you? And one of the things that I often think about is like, who are when you deal with young people, who are non-custodial adults that can be helpful here, right? Parents are often part of the problem. So they're not the first person to turn to. But like, hey, do you have like an auntie that that we can talk to, right? Is there somebody else? Because the thing is that involving somebody else can also be a core part of that process. And the other thing is, and more generally, is don't look away. Check in. Make sure they're okay, right? Again, keep the human part real. The other thing I advise people to do is to recognize that some people cry out for help in ways that are very clearly crying out for help. But some people also cry out for help in ways that are aggressive, right? They scream, they yell, they kick. And online, what that means is that they pick fights. Right. And so this is one of those things where it's like when somebody's picking a fight with you, rather than getting immediately responsive and reactive into that fight, start with a state of empathy. Right. Like, hey, everything okay? Or some version of that. Or like, also like, what you just wrote made me feel really icky. Like, I don't know that you meant to do that. Can we talk about it? Diffuse. Right. And so then more generally, especially for those who are thinking about education, like I'm a big believer in social emotional learning programs, otherwise known as SEL. And the thing about social emotional learning, which is relevant for both young people and older people, is that SEL teaches you to think in terms of resilience, right? And think in terms of like strengthening resilience, focusing on empathy, focusing on diffusing a social situation, right? And this is really important in a moment where often we use technology to speed up or amplify something, which is to say that because we have speed on our side, right, we can see something instantly, we're just like, we react and we just keep going and we just keep going. And there's a lot that each of us can do to de-escalate. And so those are strategies that I think everyone can take at some level, even without professional training.
Recruiting other people that could, other potential non-custodial adults. I'm going to take that with me. I think that's really pertinent. Just to see what you might think, I like this assumption almost that young people grew up in this space. And for the most part, if they come from a protective, space, they're okay. That's very helpful. I wonder if, because I'm thinking about like students or kids who are demonstrating risk online, and then students who are just kind of, using it to communicate and just be virtual. I'm wondering if there's any kind of maybe nuanced space as far as like an expression of risk. And I'll tell you, I told you I'm in my sorority house. I'm a grad student, but I live with 11 undergrads. And so they'll come in my room and just tell me the craziest things. And recently they've come in and started talking to me about these sites like Omegle or Kik, which I had never heard of. But they were sites that they joined when they were 11. And it's just a random messaging app, right? Where it messages just someone random around the world. But quickly, it just turns into a grooming kind of device, right? And when I was kind of provoking, hey, like, did you know what was going on the other side? Yeah. Were you okay with it? I think attention just feels good for kids is kind of like some of the things. And I think that that's so honest and so fair. I wonder, is there like a risk that is maybe not being noted by the youth that we should concern ourselves with? Or if it's not maladaptively affecting them, is it just a part of the digital experience perhaps, or the kind of rogue days of the digital experience?
So part of it is also just generally our anxieties about kids growing into sexual beings, right? Like, which is that, you know, when somebody is, you know, going through that process of realizing themselves as a sexual, you know, human, both the idea that they have a feelings of attraction, or that they, you know, feel the experience of, you know, somebody giving them attention because they're somebody else is attracted to them. It does feel good. It feels validating. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about technology or not. People have navigated this in a range of healthy and unhealthy manners, right? You know, when I was growing up, it was like, you know, sneaking out of the house, dressing up inappropriately and going to the mall. Right? Like that was, you know, where you were trying to pretend like you were 18 when you were 12, right? Like that is not something that is new. And our anxieties about it are age old. And so the question is how do we have a healthier conversation about sex and sexuality and identities and attractions? And, you know, this is why for me, like this never gets fixed by like, I'm going to block this technology. It's that, like, that never ends well, right? It like solves a short-term problem while leading to longer-term problems, right? And, you know, one of the things that's, you know, I'm sure you've seen is that, you know, people who've successfully managed to block kids from having any of these dynamics, but before they're 18, they show up in college and like, oh my goodness, what are we dealing with, right? Rather than building a socialization process. And I liken this in some ways to the relationship that Europeans have to alcohol versus Americans. So in the US, we pretend like nobody is going to drink until they're 21, which is not how this works in practice at all. You know, it's often, you know, whether you're starting with somebody sneaking and you know, adding water to their parents' vodka so that they can, you know, drink it at home, or finding somebody who will buy them beer. Young people are finding all sorts of ways to get alcohol long before. And so then you have different kinds of parental responses. You have plenty of parents who are like, I'm going to pretend like that's not happening, which is like, oh, bloody hell. Or parents who are like, okay, we got to figure out how to navigate this in different ways. Or parents who are just like, I'm going to punish you every time I figure it out, right? There's like all sorts of variations. Look at this in Europe, where mostly the law is 18. There's still a law. And you, once again, you will never find, you know, there's tons and tons of kids under 18 that are drinking. Why? Because they've been socialized into it. They're drinking wine with their parents. They're at dinner. They're having conversations about alcohol. They're getting to feel what the consequences of this are. There's a whole set of rituals that do this. The result is that the college age population in Europe still drinks, but spends less time totally wrecked and hungover in their classes than the typical American kid, right? And they have far fewer, you know, truly devastating outcomes than we do here. This is also true around sex and sexuality, right? Which is that you can start this conversation. And this is one of the reasons why I go back to the, you know, the importance of non-custodial adults. Nobody wants to talk to their mother about their sex life. Like, ew, gross, right? But there's probably an auntie, right? Or there's probably some like cool older cousin or somebody in your network. And if there's not, like the thing I tell parents, I'm like, build those people, right? Build those people actively. Not that they're going to tell you your kid's having sex, but like that they're going to be able to be there and be like, you know what a condom is, right? Like those kinds of conversations. But to those younger ages, recognizing that young people are doing it and being able to highlight it for them and finding ways to acknowledge them is critical. They're having crushes long before that, right? So it's like, at what point can we start navigating that? And I think that's what, for me, then when a young person is encountering one of these services, they know what they're doing and why, right? And they can actually recognize it in themselves and be like, and here's the edge, right? Like, I don't want to meet him. Like, that guy's creepy. But like, yeah, it did feel really validating for this moment, right? That's the thing about building up capacity. Because otherwise, you're just delaying the problem, right? And I think being able to recognize when something is good attention versus toxic attention is an extremely important skill that I really wish more 18-year-olds had, right? Because I think we'd have fewer problems on campus if more 18-year-olds had an understanding of where edges were.
Absolutely. It makes so much sense with your argument to build capacity. It makes so much sense. My reductive question was, who builds these capacities? But I think something that you're saying is society. You don't put it just on parents or teachers, or you wouldn't put it on policymakers, right? Or would you is this just a society kind of needing to confront a new medium or a new affordance?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to do it all up. And that's my point, is I wouldn't separate it out from the internet versus in person, right? The same toxic behavior happens in a football game, right? Like, so how do you build that capacity? And this is where, you know, like an invitation to all of your sorority students is like, adopt some teenagers, right? Like be the big sisters, right? Like that moment of like, every one of us can take responsibility, not just for ourselves, but the people in our world, right? The people that are around us. We can be the cool aunties, right? And that's why I think it's really important that we don't reinforce this hyper-individualism. It's all on you, or it's all on parents or the state, right? A lot of it is much more collective action. Like, and so that's the thing is that if each of us sat there and be like, who am I going to be an auntie to, right? Thoughtfully. That would make a huge difference, right? And so that's where I think, you know, and you know, it's great to fund boys and girls clubs, and it's great to fund big brothers, big sisters. Like, all of these things are fabulous, but it doesn't require an institution. It can just be a choice that we make as individuals to devote ourselves to supporting people around us.
Okay. Second to last question, I want to ask you, how do you think that we, I'm going to follow you to the end of the earth. So how do you think that we get this message out? I am seeing a lot of learned helplessness. I've interviewed parents, cousins, all kinds of people. And I'm seeing such a learned helplessness and a lack of knowing how to navigate, or the empowerment to feel like you are an authority to navigate this space. And maybe a waiting for policymakers to do something. So we're seeing things like Kids Online Safety Act coming out that's really exciting, animating some parents just because they're desperate for this conversation. But maybe they haven't heard from you that they could empower themselves to be a healthy auntie and just check up on their fellow society. So I wonder how you think about getting this message to the people, which you're a fabulous public scholar, by the way, and you are doing this. Well,
I appreciate you, but I honestly don't think that I am doing it well, and I don't know. If I knew, I would be trying to do it better. I mean, I try in different ways, but I think that, you know, one of the things that's really hard about parents and parenting is that it's a life stage, right? Right. And so, like, you know, the anxieties that you have as a parent of a 4-year-old, then anxieties that you have as a parent of a 10-year-old, then 16-year-old. And by the time you're through and your kids are off in college, you're like, oh, I'm not going to think about this again. And they're on to the next generation of parents that are coming through, and you're like, oh my gosh. And so I say this because, you know, there's a bunch of structural dynamics that have gotten us here, you know, where we do put so much more pressure on parents. But we've also created a culture where this is actually far more at the root of what it means to be American than I think most people realize. And so let me give some funny, weird examples here. And I think we should talk a little bit about COSA for a second, which is to say that We are the only member nation of the United Nations that never ratified the UN Rights of the Child. This is really important. The UN Rights of the Child is a structure that says, like, children should not be abused. Children should be educated. Children should have access to food. Lots of things. But also recognizing children have agency. And the reason that we haven't is that we actually have rooted this entire history of this country in the idea of parental rights. And if you want to see how deep it goes, when in the Constitution, we put in Article 1, Section 2, the mandatory requirement of creating a census, we chose to do a bunch of really wackadoodle things, including the idea, a very racist idea, that indigenous people would not count and that enslaved populations would count as 3/5 of a person. Okay. We ratified and resolved the issue with regard to, you know, counting enslaved peoples, mostly, of course, Black populations, with the 14th Amendment, where we basically said, no, they count as full people. Thank you very much. The indigenous history is much messier. We've never actually officially said it. We just say that they're now taxed so we can count them. We also gave suffrage to women, because up until that point, the whole history of it was that the white male landowner would get the political weight of their women, children, and enslaved peoples. That was their political weight. And so it wasn't just that we counted these populations in different ways. It's that it all was to give power to that white male landowner. The interesting thing is that, you know, thanks to suffrage, women can vote. Not all adult citizens can vote, but many can. And we have to acknowledge the way in which we've actually really harmed people who have been incarcerated in different ways. But the thing is, children don't vote. Children are still political property that give weight, political power and weight to their parents when it comes to our democracy. It is at that level of depth. And the thing is that we are now at a moment where we're having parental rights fights left, right, and center. And these parental rights fights are no longer just, you know, about things like, you know, political weight. They're much deeper. And so one of the things that we saw in the 2022 cycle of the election was the question of whether or not, you know, children should have access to information that would lead them to access gender-affirming care, right, for transgender children. This was a huge battle. It's also a battle in the background of what's going on right now. Like, if you go down to Denver, there's a big ad from Epoch Times, which is, you know, basically saying to go to their website, which is where they have some of the most intense anti-trans propaganda on their site. They created an entire film to try to convince parents that they are losing their children to gender-related propaganda, right? And we have John Haidt out there arguing that gender is contagion. This is actually what's at the core of the Kids Online Safety and Privacy Act. So in the United States, we do not have a federal law that gives parents control over their children. Age of consent is a state law, okay? And so this is this really interesting challenge, because if you believe that parents should have ultimate power, you want to build the frameworks at the federal level to block children from being able to make decisions on their own without parental approval. And this is not just about the internet. This is about access to abortion and contraception. This is about access to gender-affirming care and information. This is about access to mental health, which notably in the United States, if you are on your insurance policy of your parents until you're 26, you're not going to seek mental health support for fear that you have to talk to your parents about it, right? That's a really bad configuration. And so when you see a bill like COSPA come up that's pretending about helping kids, it is not meant to help kids. It's meant to build the framework and the rubric that makes certain that parents have control over children and their bodies. And that is deeply worrying to me, right? Because I do not want to see the situation where vulnerable youth who are struggling with their parents, lose all forms of agency. And the fact that we do not acknowledge that children should have power, like regardless of their parents, is a deep problem. And that is rooted into our technology logics, that's rooted into our laws, that's rooted into our culture. And that is the thing that for me, you know, when I think about trying to fight back, I want to push against this. I want to focus on empowering people, not because we can't acknowledge like laws. Laws can be useful, but these laws aren't meant to be useful. And government is not going to come in and quote unquote save us from all of these problems that we have with technology or with society. The law cannot stop bullying, right? And so we actually have to focus on other paths forward. And every one of us has the agency to do that and to support people through these processes, which is why for me, it's about shifting that balance of power and acknowledging that what we can do is multi-layered. The simplest is those auntie roles. There's many other steps there as well that can go much deeper, but at the very least, let's start with the auntie role.
Thank you for going into that. I read the COSA statement kind of quickly because I'm in the children's media kind of policy space or trying to be in that research as well. And I'll be honest, I read it and I was very excited. And then I read your critique. And then I felt a deep understanding about what you're saying and a fear as well. I hope that people are able to really see the critiques that you're levying and not just kind of get wrapped up in the rhetoric and the moral panic of it all, because you're 100% right. And the Heritage Foundation also released a critique that substantiates what you were saying as well. It's a pretty big privacy concern, surveillance concern. Just
ironic when Heritage and I are the same same political position.
That's something.
No, but it's an interesting situation because like the underlying logics that are animating people to be excited about it, like should these technologies be designed better? Yes. Like I don't have any disagreements with that. Right. It's a question of how do you do it? Right. And I don't think that dictating to these companies like thou shalt design to stop bullying, it does a darn bit of good. Right. And, you know, if you want to say, you know, I vote that we tax all of these companies to pay for social services, I'm game. Like, go for it. If you want to regulate what they can and can't advertise, please have a field day. Right. Like these are things where I'm like, they can have control over this. Yes, it will hurt their bottom line. I have no objection to that, right? Like, that's not where my fight is. My fight is that I want to make certain that vulnerable youth are able to get the support that they need and able to not just be locked back in a corner where they can't be seen, right? Like, and so that, and these tools aren't used to backfire. And it's also the same thing I feel about, like, you know, all of these, you know, attempts to build laws to say that schools should block, you know, phones from the classroom. I'm like, I have no objection with a teacher saying no phones or a principal saying no phones, right? Like totally reasonable to me. But that's within a pedagogical context where you're making decisions that fit with you. Having the law say if you have a phone in the classroom, you will lose federal funding. Like, no, that is not constructive. And so this is where I'm trying to find ways through these things where, you know, we acknowledge that, like, of course the phone can be distracting in the classroom. Like, and of course teachers can be boring, right? Like that's just part of the, you know, dynamic. So it's like, you know, scroll cute cats on the internet, listen to my teacher, right? Like I get it. But that's why you don't do this by regulation. You don't solve these problems by regulation. You have to abstract back out another layer and say, what is actually going on here? And how do we address it in a holistic way? And in a way that actually, you know, is the right actors making the right moves in the right places.
Thank you, Nina, personally. And for all of our listeners who were wondering, perhaps, you know, like, where does some of the power come in, our own power come in? And I think that you're kind of spotlighting our own power here and capacity to build the society that we want to see.
Just for my hope for.
For my final question, can I just, reflecting on your career studying young people and technology, just what's one thing that you think we should pay more attention to or consider for the future of youth online or just ourselves as supporters of youth online?
The thing is, take them seriously, right? Like, which is to say that, you know, young people are human too. They're, you know, when they're trying to make sense of this world, which is messy and complicated. And of course they have fewer experiences. Of course they have less information, right? The number of times around the sun allows us to like have more of those experiences. But there's age is not the only factor at play here, right? There's a lot more that goes on to you know, building us up. And that's where I think, you know, we have created, over the 20th century, we, especially in the United States, we created such an individualistic society, and where it's all about the individual, where it's all competition, where it's all, you know, you're on your own, good luck. We can change that. And we can change that by empowering young people, by working with young people, by listening to young people. And, you know, recognizing that they're just trying to make sense of the world that they have landed in, right? Like they're here and they're like, what is this weird world? And so for me, I think it's not so much that there's one, you know, here's the research question that needs to be done. It's more of a state of mind, and to acknowledge that, you know, in our political economy, parents have a lot more power, right? Government has a lot more power. And in order to actually truly empower young people, we need to actually build up their capacity and be their amplifiers, right? And so there's an interesting opportunity for, you know, all of us who are adults to create the conditions where their voices can rise and to create the conditions where they can be connected, you know, as members of society and not just have to wait until some magical age to be a part of public life. And so that to me is like the real thing is like, how do you get that mindset and approach, you know, the puzzles that we face like collectively, as opposed to just saying like, you know, there's going to be magic fixes. There's never going to be magic fixes, but we can work together to make a lot of change happen.
Thank you, Dana. This has been a treasure. And I hope our listeners understood it as a treasure as well, because we're so grateful and lucky to have this time with you. You're a public scholar that we could all follow. Thank you. Oh,
thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks to everyone listening.
You've been listening to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology. Looks Like New comes to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. You can find us on airwaves across Colorado's Front Range on KGNU Community Radio on the fourth Thursday of every month and online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month.